Welcome to What is Going Om for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello. Once upon a time, a young man set out on a quest for meaning in the modern world. In the years that followed, he evolved from a youthful and very successful athlete to an elder teacher of practical and spiritual life skills. Sounds like a fairy story, doesn't it? But it's not, for along the way, he experienced some major roadblocks physically and spiritually, which forced him to dig deeper inside himself than many of us are willing to venture, to find the strength and determination to heal his body and nourish his hungry spirit. The road was long, the lessons were hard, and as one would expect in any quest, the answers didn't always appear like magic. But he started writing about his experiences and what he learned, and before long, he became a hugely influential spiritual author and teacher. Now, 42 years after publishing his breakthrough book, which became a major movie and created the foundation for all that he's learned and taught since, he's finally sharing the true story of his spiritual quest in a much-anticipated memoir called Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit. Former world champion athlete, university coach, martial arts instructor, college professor, spiritual quester, and best-selling author and teacher of Way of the Peaceful Warrior, Dan Millman. Welcome back to What is Going Om.
Oh, what a lovely welcome and introduction, Sandy. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
You too, Dan. So, your book, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, was published in 1980. That's 42 years ago. So it's taken that long to write your memoir. Why this length of time?
My life has been a constant evolution, like most of ours. And it seemed to me that from my vantage point of 75 years at the present time was a good time to reflect on that past. It would have been premature, I think, for me at least, to write memoir until I had more years to look back on than perhaps forward to. But I wanted to write it while I had clear memory and thought process. So this seemed like good timing.
Way of the Peaceful Warrior and some of your other books have blended fact with fiction, and you can't really do that in a memoir. But given that you're a teacher and a storyteller, were you ever tempted to weave some fictional elements into the memoir to underscore a lesson or a specific teaching moment?
No, I wasn't. Even though my first book, I structured it around my life, so Way of the Peaceful Warrior, of all my books until the new one, has more autobiography, and my other books I have recommended to readers that they treat them like novels. They essentially are works of fiction. However, Way of the Peaceful Warrior does blend a considerable autobiography. But I left some ambiguity, as you know, what was true, what wasn't. So for the memoir, I was rigorous in my approach to checking with my memories against relatives and friends during various times. So I can honestly say it's the absolute best effort I could make to tell a true story. But everything is a story. We select, as you know, facts and ideas, and we paint things certain colors. But I've tried to maintain a full level of candor, truthfulness, and openness in writing this.
You've described Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit as the memoir of a spiritual quest. It also describes your evolution, you're from student to teacher. You'd already had a lot of experience of being a coach, the director of gymnastics at Stanford, an assistant professor of physical education. But the type of teaching that you moved into after Way of the Peaceful Warrior was less about the physical and more about the spiritual, which is a whole different ball game. Did you find that daunting? Was it difficult for you?
Well, you know the saying, we can only understand life looking backwards, but we have to live it forwards. And the time I was evolving and learning, yes, I did encounter considerable difficulties along the way, as we all do, I think. But I think in the writing of the book and my own evolution, it just seemed like destiny and a process unfolding, looking back.
Mm. You say about your memoir that this story is mine, but the way belongs to us all, that this open path of living with a peaceful heart and a warrior's spirit is accessible to anyone. But, you know, from a very early age, you dedicated yourself to discipline, to pushing the envelope of your physical and mental capabilities, and to perseverance, even in the face of massive odds. How can someone who doesn't have decades of training in gymnastics and martial arts find their way? Where do they start?
Well, I'm entirely and fully aware of my humanity and my commonality with everyone out there. Yes, the story is mine, the details of the story. I suppose I was hardwired, perhaps born with the idea of striving for recognition and achievement. And playing on the edge of fear. I discovered that in growing up, and I describe in the memoir, in Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, how even when I was a toddler, I was heading out into the street to fetch a ball. My father, in the last minute, saw me going out and grabbed me and pulled me back. So I might have had my demise while still in diapers. And my childhood did reflect that interest in learning, curiosity, and also risk-taking, which served me well as a young athlete and trampoline performer. But it didn't serve me as well later in life when riding a motorcycle or doing certain other activities, always pushing the envelope. So I don't take credit for it, nor do I feel badly about it. It was just part of my wiring and destiny, perhaps, to push the envelope and to strive. And it moved from the arena of everyday life, and as you say, coaching physical disciplines like gymnastics, into a bigger picture of life, and largely influenced by not only my inner drives, but also the four mentors, which I'm sure we'll touch upon, that I describe in the book. Because, you know, I was acutely aware before I even began writing the memoir that we all have a story. Everyone's life has adversity, these common themes that I met in my own way. And I wouldn't presume to write a book. I'm not some huge celebrity, movie star, politician, that sort of thing, where I couldn't presume people simply wanted to read about my life. Why? I mean, there are many, many lives out there. But I wanted to convey something about the evolution that I underwent, because it in a way, leaves a trail of breadcrumbs that other people might at least recognize in their own path and their own evolution. But also, it is a bit of a cautionary tale, and I think fully fleshed out tale of various approaches to what we call spiritual practice and the spiritual quest. So it's really more than anything a book about the spiritual quest and what that means and how it may impact the lives of readers and listeners. So that's why I justified writing this book.
You mentioned in the book that insight emerged only after lengthy periods of preparation, course corrections, and humbling wake-up calls. I know you're a man who likes to live in the now, but writing one's memoir does require a kind of life review process. So I wonder if in doing that, did you have any surprising new epiphanies or perceptual shifts about past events?
I like that question very much, because it gives me a chance first to explain. It's so easy for us to slip into ideas about the present moment rather than what it actually consists of. And as I often remind readers, we can't live anywhere but the present moment. We're always in the eternal present. The rest is illusion, is imagination, memory, imagination of the future, memory of the past. Even when I'm remembering the past, even when I spend hours reflecting on my early life, I'm doing it in the present moment. It's simply sorting through memories, a brain synapses, if you will. So it's not a matter of either or, that reflecting on my life means I'm no longer in the present. We have this wonderful power to imagine and to remember. So I use those abilities, but I recognize I'm always here and now while I'm looking into these memories. And it was quite a process. It's like some people out there may have gone to a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year or more high school reunion. And it's an amazing experience when you see these people you haven't seen for 40 or 50 years, in my case, and bam, their names are right there. There's Roger, there's Sue, there's Sally, there's Amir. You know, I remember them and I never thought I would, and these synapses open up. These memories just click in, these associations. So one memory led to another. And when I first wrote the book, Sandy, I had a bloated, overwritten 500-page autobiography, just a memory dump, a download of everything I could remember. Figuring out the chronology was not always easy. That's when I really wished I had been more disciplined in keeping a journal. If I had kept a journal, even a few notes every day, I had to rely on my old computer calendars, some of which I couldn't access anymore, to remember the chronology. It's easy to, because today, at my age, you know, my sense of the past is today, yesterday, and sometime in the past. So I had to, that was the hard work of preparation, of getting these things in the correct chronology, because it makes more sense. And once I did that and did this 500-page draft, then I cut it down to 400 pages, then 300 pages, and in the end, just over 200 pages. So I had to cut out a lot of detritus, of things that wouldn't necessarily be of interest to anyone but my family or even them. So I didn't just write this for my family or my children or grandchildren. I wanted to write it for the broad readership who might find some illumination in going through this particular story and seeing the universal elements in it.
You said that your life and your career as a teacher and author make sense only in retrospect. Say a bit more about that.
Well, Michael Crichton, we all know the writer Michael Crichton, yeah. He once said the difference between life and fiction is that fiction has to make sense. And that's humorous, but it's true as well. Fiction needs to make sense when you read it, and a memoir has to make sense. It has to be told in a way like a story, and yet, in this case, fact-based. So it's not just for my readers who have been curious about how much is true in my books and what was my life really like, because Peaceful Warrior was written for a particular purpose, a teaching purpose, in a way also about the spiritual quest. So there will be things in this book, such as my experience with LSD and how that impacted, for example, some of the visionary elements I wrote about in Way of the Peaceful Warrior. People wonder, where did that come from? Did Dan really have those journeys by getting grabbed by his head by Socrates? So some of those revelations I think will be interesting to readers of my work and fans. But I also, you know, when you write a book, any book, you have to keep in mind, who is my audience? Who is my readership? And speak to them. And so for this book, I also wanted to speak to people who may have heard of me or seen the Peaceful Warrior movie, but not read any of my books, but have a vague curiosity. Oh, it's about the true story of his spiritual quest. I'm interested in spiritual quests. And maybe that would serve them as well.
You know, a lot of books that, you know, look at the hero's journey, the spiritual quest, etc., people's memoirs, when you trace their life, there appears to be, you know, many lucky synchronicities, things like that. And there were certainly appear to be a number of those in your life. But they, I get the sense from reading the book that you were determined right from the beginning to dive in and dive very deep and be very serious and very disciplined and follow the breadcrumbs, you know, that showed up for you and not shy away from anything. And that's the opinion that I get from the book. Is that true?
Yes, I would say I would agree with that. You know, we've all heard that the Chinese character of crisis is made up of two characters. The ideogram is danger and opportunity. And so there were times of risk or danger, but decision points. And I was guided in some sense, call it inner guidance or instinct or just my own innate interest to make certain choices. And some of them weren't particularly wise. But in retrospect, you know, faith, F-A-I-T-H, I believe faith is the courage to live as if everything that arises and every choice we make will be for our highest good and learning. Now, I can't know that's true, but I like to operate on that as an operating principle. Faith is the courage to live as if every choice we make and everything that happens to us will serve our highest good and learning. I think it's a resourceful approach. And so I think to some degree I was informed by this before I could even articulate it as a principle in my, as you've read about.
Yeah. So in Way of the Peaceful Warrior, Socrates was your teacher, your mentor. But in Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, you say that while many authors and role models inspired you, there were four mentors who had the greatest impact on your life and work. And we won't go too deeply into what attracted you to each of them, but I am, you know, I do have a couple of questions about these because there's some fascinating questions that arise when you read the book. You say that they appeared within a vast field of other teachers, gurus, and spiritual authorities, some benign, others dangerous or deluded. I love the way you write, by the way. And it wasn't always easy to discern one type from the other. So how did you make your decisions about which ones to follow and listen to? I mean, were you somebody who always relied on your gut, your instinct, very early on?
Well, I had to physically. As a child who was bullied, I was younger and smaller than many of my peers in size. And so I was bullied. Many men and women in different ways have stories when they were young, where children might have bullied or teased them and so on. And that led me to an interest in martial arts and then acrobatics. So I had to learn to trust my instincts in terms of my body, my physical body and movement. And that was a good beginning. It was a good foundation in my case, that physical grounding. Rather than getting lost in abstract theories, it was always about practical outcomes. One way I sometimes put it today is one, you know, that push-ups are an exercise, and meditation is also an exercise. They have different purposes, and they look different. The primary difference between push-ups and meditation, however, is that you can't pretend to do push-ups. So sometimes people can sit and daydream and look like they're meditating. So that grounding kept me out of the abstract ethers of abstract concepts and kept me grounded in looking for the real. And I think one blessing and curse in my case, I was quickly disillusioned. I would try this and then I would see through it. And I would go, let's move on, onward. That was always my mantra, kind of onward. Then I would try that, onward. I tried different martial arts, different focuses on exercise. And when I came to these four mentors, and again, I didn't meet them all at the same time. As you know, I spent 20 years, pretty close to that, training one, then the next, and one led me to the next, and then the next. And so this is where the synchronicity comes in. As you know, the first mentor I'd never heard of until one of my former gymnastics teammates told me this, you know, this thing. He said, "Dan, drop everything and do this training." And I ended up, the circumstances allowed it at the time. So I ended up saying, yes, it sounded right. So it was on his recommendation that drew me first to this school. And I called him the professor. And again, bigger picture here, of course, the four mentors represent pretty much some of the major approaches people take to what they call spiritual practice. The professor had a very deep intellectual grasp, a technological grasp of a global heritage of spiritual exercises and practices. He had studied major traditions and mastered them in his own story, which I relate in brief in the book. And so the professor had one approach, and I started out with a 40-day, 10-hour-a-day, 40-day training, an intensive training, and then an advanced training, and then further work in this school. Whereas the second mentor was a guru. He was a traditional guru where he shot, you know, a spirit or God, the transcendent, shines through his physical form. And so that was a very different approach, not technologically, doing a lot of practices and techniques, but it was more a direct relationship. And the third mentor was quite different from the first two. At the time, I needed someone, a pick-me-up in a way. He was called the warrior priest. That's what I call him. And he gave me not only tools, but an approach, a persona, a confidence, a sense of adventure, which I hadn't exactly found in the first two schools. And again, as you know, it's inappropriate for me to try to describe all this and the whole process and nuances, which I do in the book, of course. Yeah. But the warrior priest was very different from the professor or the guru. And finally, this disillusion and leaving one, then another, the reasons I approached and the reasons I moved on, were all there. And I hope to take the reader with me. If I've done my job, the reader is going, "Oh, I wish I'd worked with the professor. That sounds fantastic." But then when it's time to take my leave, they kind of understand why I left. And the same thing with the guru. I was a student, in a sense, devotee of this guru for about 8 years of my life, while many other changes happened. And then moving on to the warrior priest for a relatively brief time, about a year and a half, before I discovered, I had no interest by this time in any other teachers. I'd been there, done that. I'd done all the techniques and practices in depth, and I'd experienced this radiant master with feet of clay. And then this adventures. I had a career and calling by the time I'd finished processing with the warrior priest. And finally, the sage, he brought me back to earth and reminded me about simple reality. It's not exactly Zen, but he had a background in that. But his approach to living was so realistic. It actually refined and illuminated my perspectives after all that I had done. And I didn't simply take these teachings that I learned from these various people, the content, and rehash them and begin teaching them. It didn't work like that. For some reason, their teachings were appropriate to them in their time, and I had to form a whole new way, free of jargon, grounded in reality, that I could teach, that I call the Peaceful Warrior's Way. But they opened the doors of insight that helped me to eventually evolve into what I'm doing now. So that's a mouthful, but there you are.
And each of those mentors, as you say, had their gifts and their blind spots, and you cover both with admirable candor. Many people feel that, like Caesar's wife, spiritual teachers must be above reproach, which of course is impossible. We're all human. But the challenge for many followers is, you know, when a teacher falls off their pedestal, is how do you keep the message without killing the messenger? What's your view on that?
Well, you raise a very large and important question. Many of us have had a chance today to, for example, there may be an actor we admire, and then we find out their life is kind of a mess, or a head of industry, or a movie producer. And then in the Me Too time, we realize that they have some serious flaws. Great artists, let's say Michelangelo, in his time, he may have been abusive to women. Do we no longer appreciate his art? So the art or the artist, how do we resolve that? And I don't have an easy answer, but I do know I can see the beauty in the art they created, even these flawed, imperfect individuals. And one of the memes, in fact, one of the themes of Peaceful Heart Warrior Spirit is that every teacher is human, and every human has foibles or flaws, including me. Fortunately, my wife, Joy, keeps me more or less on the straight and narrow. She will let me know about it if I do anything out of integrity, which I really don't do very often. But I'm out there. I'm a human being. I have flaws and sillinesses. If life is a series of moments, sometimes I'm very intelligent. I have intelligent moments. Other times I have some stupid moments. Ask my daughters, who are all grown up now. Love them dearly. They love me, but they know their dad. So we have to see one another as with compassion, but also, you know, we keep our heart open, but also our eyes open. And so the fact that my mentors, some more than others, had these various foibles doesn't negate the teaching. Maybe we've heard of Chogyam Trungpa, a great Tibetan master, but probably also an alcoholic. Alan Watts. Most of us have heard of Alan Watts, a brilliant professor of Zen and Taoism for people to understand. Well, he was quite a rake and also heavily used alcohol as well. So, and many, many fine teachers have had problems with sex and or money, but you can't throw out the teachings. It doesn't negate them. They are simply human beings, imperfect vessels, and we can judge them. We can discern and say they made these mistakes, and let's not make those. And I was also taught by their negative examples in cases, and yet they produced some absolutely brilliant, radiant teachings that guided me in my life. So that's the best way I can answer that. It has to be nuanced. There's no simple answers here.
Yeah, and I mean, you just said it yourself, didn't you? That, I mean, we can learn even from the things that we weren't happy about with them.
Yes, yes, just like our parents.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to take a short break now, Dan. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is former world champion athlete and internationally respected spiritual teacher, Dan Millman, who, of course, is the best-selling author of the iconic Way of the Peaceful Warrior book. And we're talking about his latest release, his memoir, Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, The True Story of My Spiritual Quest, in which he reflects on the extraordinary experiences that shaped his evolution from youthful dreamer to spiritual teacher. We'll be back with more from Dan Millman after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
Vox Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Join me every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio for Vox Novus, the new voice.
Mental health. Most people think it means mental illness. Most people are wrong. Mental health doesn't apply to just some of us. It applies to everyone. We're all susceptible to anxiety and depression. They're human conditions, and no person should ever feel embarrassed, ashamed, or be discriminated against for being human. Cracked the Podcast strips away the shame, fear, and stigma by expanding the conversation into areas less often visited. From brain and body chemistry, hormones, food, nutrition, trauma, and the microbiome, to pharmaceutical drugs, psychedelic substances, meditation, visionary experiences, and spiritual awakenings. Cracked the Podcast will explore them all, including the notion that, for many, breakdown can be the beginning of breakthrough. For in the words of singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, there is a crack in everything. It's where the light gets in. Cracked the Podcast, slaying the dragons of mental health. Join co-hosts Sandy Sedgbeer and Rebecca Shaper on the first and third Thursday of every month at 12 noon Eastern Time.
COVID-19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
If you're feeling increasingly lonely right now, you're not alone. It's totally normal. Even though we may not be able to get together in person, connecting virtually with friends and family still gives you a chance to interact with people and may help raise your spirits. Join a virtual book club, set up group text chats, or online video coffee breaks with coworkers.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Welcome back. Dan Millman, you made an amazing recovery from a shattered thigh bone. And that was a really amazing recovery, and it was done with great determination and great perseverance. I know a young man, a judo champion, who's worked hard to achieve, you know, incredible status, who had an awful accident a year or so ago. Very similar to your story, except he shattered many more bones. And he's now back at his judo club a year later, miraculously training again, may never compete again. But what would you say to somebody like this who, you know, has a similar experience to the one you had, but it doesn't look as though they're going to get over that?
I've had correspondence with many such people because they had an injury and wondered what could they do, thinking after reading Way of the Peaceful Warrior that the character Socrates, you know, somehow gave me extra energy and did some semi-magical type of things to intervene. But as you know from reading the memoir, Sandy, it was just a process of healing and hard work. And that's all we can do. Life has taught me that we cannot control the outcomes in our lives as much as we might like to. But we can control the efforts we make over time. And by making a good effort, a persistent effort over time, we increase the odds and the chances of getting the outcomes we desire over not making the efforts. So in a sense, effort is success. And effort over time is the horse I'm betting on. Many people like magical things they can do with their mind to intend and hope and wish, and believing that if they just visualize it, it will come to be. And maybe there's some benefits in doing creative visualization and so on. But we also need to take the action necessary. So that's what I have said to various correspondents. And that process of digging ourselves out of a hole strengthens us to climb the mountain. So there is a benefit in every adversity. It creates more compassion, strength, wisdom, perspective. Whether or not we get back to whatever we were doing beforehand. So we can't predict these things. And I'd like to, you know, provide sort of inspiring comments, you can do it and all that. But each of us has a different destiny. And sometimes it's the old cliche, but I love the cliches because they have some universal truths that they say when God closes a door, God opens a window. So who knows? If somebody can no longer compete, they may end up being a brilliant coach or take up writing or do other things and find satisfaction in another direction. But if their goal is to return, a young athlete, for example, like the judoka you described to me, then go for it. Many people talk about expectations, how our lives are shaped not so much by our experiences, by our expectations. But my view, the way I've developed is I no longer believe in high expectations or low expectations or any expectations. My life was so fraught with uncertainty at various points, I just said, I'll go for it and see what happens. That's where I was when I was on the beach doing strength exercises with my right leg looking like a stick, unable to bear weight. I just started doing dips and upper body strength, and I did what I could, and I kept doing it. And over time, things got better, and then I made a quote-unquote miraculous recovery. But miracles happen when, you know, when we prepare for them.
Mm, yeah. What does it mean to have a peaceful heart and a warrior spirit? You know, I've been thinking about this for myself, and I'm not sure that I have either. How would you guide me along this path? And is it ever too late?
Well, the last part of your question is easy to respond to. It's never, ever too late, unless we die. And even then, maybe it's not too late. Who knows? But in terms of, it's not some thing we achieve. It's an ongoing process. You know from your own experience, Sandy, as do your listeners, and as do I, that some moments we feel more peaceful than others. And that's perfectly natural. In fact, I once asked the sage, one of my mentors, how I could have a more peaceful mind. And he said, if your house is on fire, maybe an active and clear mind, an assertive mind, is more helpful than a peaceful mind in that situation. So he said, maybe the best thing is having a flexible mind according to circumstance. So in terms of a peaceful heart, what does that mean? It's a very good question. Obviously, I've thought about it. All of us are striving to live with a more peaceful heart, a sense of equanimity, serenity, in the face of the chaos sometimes of everyday life. As I've reminded people, life comes at us in waves of change that we can neither predict nor control, but we can learn to surf those waves. And so living with a peaceful heart is about learning that sense of equanimity. It's not a feeling we have because we have less control. One of the things the sage reminded me of, we have less control over the feelings that pass through us moment to moment than we do over our actions. We can't just will ourselves to feel differently from the way we do. So sometimes I feel more peaceful and calm and serene than others. But I am always striving to live with that, being like the center of the cyclone. That still point where I can look at the world through eyes of compassion, understanding, equanimity. That's what I mean by a peaceful heart. And as far as a warrior spirit goes, we all recognize there have been times in our lives and will be times where we need that warrior spirit. Not about fighting necessarily, except maybe with the inner battles with self-doubt, insecurity, and so on. But in the world, it's more about rolling up our sleeves and going for it, taking risks at times in our lives, making decisions that require some courage. You know, you have to let go of one side of the pool to swim to the other. So that requires a warrior spirit at times. We all know what that means, intuitively.
Yeah.
Male or female, it makes no difference at all, whatever we identify with. So this implies a kind of balance, which is why, oddly enough, you know, I've taught workshops, seminars, trainings for 40 years now, at least 40 years. And who shows up to them? Almost 50% are male, almost 50% are female. Very close to that. You might say, that's unusual, Dan, because most spiritual practices and seminars, usually about 85 to 90% are female. But my work has attracted a balance because peaceful heart, warrior spirit. Anybody can relate to the idea of being a peaceful warrior in training. So I didn't make this up in some strategic way. In fact, in the memoir, I describe how I actually came up with the term peaceful warrior. It was organic to my life.
Yeah. Your life has been a quest for how to live wisely and well, and I'm sure that different answers have appeared at different times. What does living wisely and well mean to you now?
At this point in time, it's responding to circumstances which change over time. You know, when life is going well for us, we don't want change.
No.
We want it to continue. But when life isn't going well, if there's something we're striving for that isn't happening, then we want change. Usually it's something, a circumstance around us. But it's as many people make that fundamental shift when they get interested in spiritual practice, they realize they need to change themselves, not constantly trying to change the world, which is less responsive sometimes. So, living wisely and well is adapting to circumstances. Wisdom, the better part of wisdom is perspective, is gaining a perspective and, yes, this will pass too, that sort of thing, to understand more about the actions or the consequences of our actions, how taking a particular decision or action may impact us later on, seeing more of the unforeseen consequences. And therefore, perhaps making wiser decisions. One of the things I emphasize in my teaching today, Sandy, is self-knowledge. And this is not new. In the Temple of Apollo, in ancient Greece, the words were written, obviously, in Greek, know thyself. Every spiritual tradition emphasizes knowing yourself, illuminating your shadow, seeing yourself realistically, which I learned in some rather unique ways with the sage. So the reason we want self-knowledge is because if we don't know ourselves, if we are still only know our self-image, if we're too young to really have confronted who we are and accepted that, what are my talents? What are my values? What are my interests? To really know these things rather than what I think I should do or other people or parents think I should do. But really, what are my talents? What am I interested in? And what are my values? Once we know that, we end up making wiser decisions. If we don't know ourselves, we make the right decision for the wrong person, the one we thought we were. And I perhaps did that when younger in a relationship I had when young. And we make decisions about career. If we don't know ourselves, we make one kind of decision. And once we know ourselves, we start making wiser decisions. So I suppose That's what I mean by living wisely and well. But it's based on actions, what we actually do, not just thoughts or internal processes.
Yeah, yeah. One of your teachers introduced you to a form of numerology, and you ended up writing the book, The Life You Were Born to Live. Looking back over your life, do you feel that you have lived the life that you were born to live? Okay, well, it looks as though we've lost Dan shortly. I'm sure he'll be back with us any second now. And while we're waiting for him, I'll just tell you that the book is published by New World Library. And it is an absolutely fascinating book to read. And it is full of incredible takeaways that I'm certainly really enjoying. So let's see if Dan can join us and we can finish this off.
Yes. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Dan.
Now, that to me was a perfect example. It was a circumstance that I couldn't control. Suddenly, I was cut off. I have no idea why, and I wasn't going to ruminate on that. I simply redialed the number, and here we are again. So that is a perfect living example in the moment of what I was talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. So you didn't get to hear the question that I asked then about your book, The Life You Were Born to Live.
I did, just before we
you
were cut off.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel that you've lived the life that you were born to live?
Absolutely. And yeah. And we are all living the life we are born to live. But we may not be living it with as much clarity or as consciously. In fact, I believe we're all in a spiritual quest, whether that's fully conscious or not. Some people would not describe their lives as a spiritual quest, but I believe we're all seeking meaning and purpose and understanding. So there you are. But the book, The Life You Were Born to Live, yes, it was based on, very directly, my work with the warrior priest. He gave me various tools to... help understand myself and help myself to help others. He had done a reading for me in our early days together, and it absolutely transformed and illuminated my path. It didn't transform my path, but it clarified who I was about. It gave me a quantum leap in self-knowledge, what we were discussing before. And when I asked him, I said, how can you know this about me? Are you a psychic? And he said, no, I'm not a psychic. He said, in fact, many psychics aren't even psychics. But he said, I've been trained to know where to look. And when I had the opportunity to go to an advanced training that he taught, where he revealed this, I jumped at it. And I wasn't learning it just for my own curiosity. I wanted to use this as a way to help others, and I started doing so right away, using my notes until I didn't need notes anymore. But I only had 20 pages of notes. For anyone familiar with the book, The Life You Were Born to Live, it's over 400 pages.
I know.
But it yeah. expanded, my insights expanded over time working with it. So I put in the work to actually write the book, where he was an oral teacher. He hadn't written anything and never actually has any books. At the end of the book, by the way, I provide, I don't know if you've seen it, Sandy, I think you have.
I have.
Provide a link for people to read more about the four mentors, their books, and so on. But I felt it was appropriate for those people who actually read through the book and went through the experience with me, which I think is a pretty balanced view of all of them. If they jump right to the internet, they'll find egregiously positive or negative things about them, and it may distort the open-mindedness with which they can approach the material. So that's why I put it at the end of the book for those readers. I hope you understand. I hope your listeners understand. But it gives them a sense of who these people are. Now, I haven't even given their names. I have no objection to giving their names, but For the sake of our discussion, I thought it was more interesting to use the archetypal roles they played in my life as the professor, the guru, the warrior priest, who is a martial arts instructor and teacher and metaphysical healer, and then the sage, who was a PhD anthropologist, psychologist. They all had different backgrounds and very different teachings. That's what made them interesting. If I'd just studied with one Zen master after another, it might not be quite the same thing. And, you know, I was always called to bread. And I had certain insights that gave me depth as well. But first I sought breadth because that gave me perspective. For example, some people take one martial art, they start when they're 12 years old or 10 or 9 or 8, and that's the art they do the rest of their life. And they get better and better at that art. But I've found you can get 80% of the benefits of an art in a shorter time. The other 20% take longer, much longer. But if I could do one art to 80% and then another to 80% and then another, which I did in studying various martial arts, it gave me a broad perspective and understanding and wisdom regarding martial arts that I wouldn't have had if I'd just done one, perhaps, and gone in depth in that one. At least that's how it worked for me. And the same is true for teachers and spiritual practices.
Yeah. And the book, you know, I was just explaining to our listeners, you know, while you were off air, that the book is absolutely full of the things that you learned. I mean, it's got so many takeaways in there. And there's one that I just can't get out of my head. And it's certainly going to be a new practice for me. And that is the one that you said, you asked yourself at the end of the day, three questions. What have I received from, you know, a particular person today? What have I given? Mm-hmm. And what troubles or difficulties have I caused them? That was a bit of a showstopper for me. It really pulled me up short. And I thought, yep, that is a really good question to go to sleep on. But we're almost out of time. And I do have another question that I have to get in. And sure. That is, since you say that inspiration passes and motivation comes and goes, you no longer try to motivate or inspire people, but instead you plant seeds that may bear fruit in times of need. What seeds would you most like to plant in our listeners' ears today?
Yes. I think it comes down to self-trust, trusting oneself as in our process. That doesn't mean we'll always make the perfect decision, but it's trusting our life unfolding to know that wherever we step, the path will appear, that we cannot truly lose our way, even though it may feel like it. So I think that's so important. Pema Chodron, the Zen teacher, said that if we trust ourselves and trust our process, it will take us as far as we can go that any teacher has ever taught. So that's what I would want to leave your listeners with. We second guess ourselves so much and compare ourselves to other people. I think it's important to respect ourselves and our own process and our own lives. And that's what I try to show in this book.
Right. Now, you've written the memoir, and having done that, do you feel that you've put a line under the past and are complete? Or is it just a line under that part of your life? And might you have something more up your sleeve moving forward?
If I do, I don't know what it is. In a way, there's a living teaching that I continue to do, and I'll continue to evolve even after the book comes out. But it does feel like a sense of completion in my writer's journey. Choreographer George Balanchine once said, I'm not looking for people who want to dance. I'm looking for people who need to dance. And, you know, I've never needed to write. I've wanted to write. And this book feels like a completion. What an appropriate place, looking back over my years. So, yes, I'm sure I have some tricks up my sleeve, but they haven't appeared even to me yet. So we'll see what happens, what unfolds.
Dan Millman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Sandy.
Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit, the true story of my spiritual quest by Dan Millman is published by New World Library. And for more information about this book and indeed all of Dan Millman's books, programs, courses and teachings of the Peaceful Warrior's Way, visit his website at peacefulwarrior.com. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer and I'll be back with you at the same time next week with another edition of What Is Going On. Till then, it's goodbye from me.